Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. As we continue our Mad Men-themed program, we now turn to the women. Jane Moss is a real-life madwoman. Moss was in the thick of the advertising industry during the 60s at Ogilvy & Mather. She began her career as a copywriter and was eventually promoted to vice president. Moss ran some of the most successful ad campaigns, including the I Love New York, flew in propeller planes for on-location shoots, and paved the way for future generations, all in high heels, pencil skirts, and perfectly coiffed hair. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jane Moss to the Roundtable.
Well, thank you for having me, Katie.
So you make the pointed statement that work came first, and then your husband, and then your children. That, to me, at this day and age, that just seems, I don't want to say cold-hearted, but, I mean, nowadays people want their children to come first.
I think it seems cold-hearted to me, too, but I'm afraid I have to say if I were to do it all over again, I would do the same thing. I would do career first, husband second, children third. And I think my advice to young women is if you want to really get to the top of the ladder, there are times when you have to put your job ahead of everything else. If you put your husband and your children first, I probably will like you more as a friend, but I don't think you'll get to the top that way.
Something like this, especially because you had graduated from Bucknell.
Yes.
And they were training and preparing young women for life as a housewife. So just bucking against that trend had to have been a major step for you.
Well, Bucknell certainly was preparing us. We would have lunch on Sundays, and then we would all gather in this great hall where the house mothers would teach us how to properly pour tea and coffee from great silver urns. That was preparing us to be housewives in the suburbs. And I never planned to be a housewife in the suburbs. My kids have turned out okay anyway. My older daughter feels sorry that she didn't have enough of me as a child, and I'm sorry about that. My younger daughter says I was the kind of mother that all her friends wished their mothers were. Instead of staying home and baking cookies, they wished their mothers were cool. And one of them said to my daughter, Jennifer, "Your mom is so cool. She's in advertising. She does everything. I bet she smokes pot." And Jennifer said, "My mother does not smoke pot." And then Jennifer realized that she had to protect my cool image. And she pulled herself together and said, "I think my mother drops acid." So that was the image I had among my daughter's friends.
Now, do you think you could have worked if you didn't have Mabel, your nanny and domestic savior?
Domestic savior is exactly the right phrase. I could not possibly have done it without Mabel. Mabel stayed with us for 35 years when my children graduated from college and left home for careers. Mabel said, "Well, I guess you won't be needing me anymore." And I said, "Mabel, don't leave me. What would I do without you?" So Mabel stayed on for another 15 years. She's now retired and living in Florida, but I invite her to come up and spend a week in New York with me a couple of times a year. We're best friends, and she's still my guardian angel.
Was it hard for you to give up that bit of control in terms of raising your kids? I mean, when you are constantly going at it, especially in the advertising industry, and having to be in control of so many people and making sure everything goes like clockwork, and then was it hard for you to, in a sense, relinquish that power to Mabel?
That's an awfully good and thoughtful question. Let me think about that for a moment. Nobody's asked me that. I think I knew that unless I relinquished the control to Mabel, we were going to have a power struggle over the kids, and that doesn't do anybody any good at all, especially the kids. So I guess I knew instinctively that if Mabel were going to be in charge of them 90% of the time, then Mabel had to be the one who said, "You have to go to sleep now, or you must drink your orange juice, or you must do this or that."
You were lucky enough that you had a husband who would support you and help you with the kids and, you know, say, will you be home tonight for a family dinner, which is definitely going against the grain in terms of what women were taught on how to be and have the dinner ready for them. Instead, your husband is helping you.
Well, Michael was extremely unusual for the 60s. I think he would be unusual for today. If on one of those rare Mondays, if one of our children had a temperature and Mabel called in simultaneously from her home in Brooklyn and said she had a cold and wouldn't be in, if I had an important meeting and Michael did not have an important meeting, he would stay home until a babysitter arrived. And it was a very rare man in those days who would call into his office and say, I'm going to be a little late, I'm babysitting. I think it's still rare to have a man who's willing to do that. It's less rare than it was all those years ago, but it still takes a very strong macho male to make that kind of decision. I was very lucky. Michael was a former Marine Corps officer, handsome, sexy, terrific. I was very lucky.
I loved reading about your relationship in this book and how you would interact with each other, and also in terms of interacting with your friends and how it just didn't mesh having his Marine Corps friends and trying to mesh them with your theater district friends.
Yes. We did have that very early on in our marriage, very early cocktail party to which Michael invited all his Marine Corps buddies, and I invited all my very flamboyant theater people buddies, and my people stood at one end of the living room and Michael's Marines stood at the other end, and never the twain did meet. And after the party was over, I cried, and we never tried to make those two worlds come together again.
I'd like to turn to the advertising part because, I mean, this is Mad Women.
Yes.
And as you say in the very beginning of the book, there are some things you can't not talk about when it comes to advertising in New York City, especially because of the TV show Mad Men, and that's sex, drinking, and the clothing.
Yes.
So first, it seems like you were fairly sheltered from the sex aspect, which is good, I think.
That I was fairly sheltered?
Yes, for you personally.
Well, I think people sort of wear neon signs in their foreheads that blink on and off and say, either I'm available or I'm not available. And I think my sign flashed, I'm not available. And most men took that fairly seriously. I think everybody I worked with knew that I was very joyously, exuberantly married. And with the exception of the one creative director who sexually harassed me for about 2 years, I really was quite protected.
And about that sexual harassment, there really wasn't any place that you could go to or an HR department because it was all run by men, and their thoughts were like, men, well, you must have done something to advance it, or you're crazy, so then that would automatically blacklist you.
Yes, it was not done, Katie, to go and whine and carry on about it. A woman was expected to handle little difficulties like sexual harassment quietly and well and not make a fuss about it. And as you said, there was no HR department. At Ogilvy, we had an office manager, but he was the one who got so drunk on the annual Ogilvy boat ride that he fell overboard and had to be fished out of the Hudson River. So he wasn't much help in the sexual harassment area. And Michael would have come to the office with his Marine Corps rifle and shot him. So I couldn't tell Michael. And so ultimately, I broke the code of silence and went to talk to David Ogilvy and said that I wished that I could get transferred to a different creative group because I thought it would help me to learn more about the advertising business, to have a change of... And then I started to cry quietly, and David, bless his heart, great man that he was, pretended he didn't see me crying, and he just said, I think it would be a very good idea for you to be switched to another group, and within 2 days, he made that happen.
And you were quite lucky with the group of people you had working at Ogilvy and Mather.
I was indeed.
I mean, some of the campaigns that you worked on were just absolutely amazing. And even with the dove and the doves flying in the window.
Well, actually, at one point we hired the trainer from Hollywood who had trained the birds in Hitchcock's movie The Birds. Mm. And he said, after those nasty ravens, these doves are going to be pretty easy. But what he didn't realize is that the doves had to do many, many, many takes. In television commercials, you do 30 or 40 takes of the same scene, as opposed to movies where you do maybe 3 or 4 takes. And so the doves got bored, and they flew up and roosted in the rafters of the studio. And we had to go and get nets and get them down. And in order to make them fly through the window on cue, don't ever tell the SPCA, I will deny it, we tied little bits of string to their claws, and on cue, the prop man and I would pull them through the window, and they'd flap their wings, and it looked terrific. We didn't hurt the pigeons, but it was hardly, they were not flying on command.
It sounds a little bit like how the different standards for commercials in terms of like this Campbell's soup and putting marbles in the bottom of the soup, and now things are changed from there of what you can use in an advertisement.
Yes, things were, remember the marbles in the soup really was not being deceptive, because what they were doing was propping the vegetables that were actually there in the soup up so they could be seen by the camera. They weren't adding vegetables that weren't there. But today, marbles in the soup to prop up low-depth vegetables would be considered deceptive advertising, and it caused quite a furor in those days.
So it's interesting how there were different camps of thinking when it came to advertising in the 60s, how some felt it had to be pounded into the consumer's mind with repetition, while others went with the irreverence.
Well, of course, the irreverence was brand new in the 60s. That was the brand new school of the advertising revolution, which was don't take your product all that seriously. For the first time in the history of advertising, Katie, it was okay to say, Avis is only number 2. We have to try harder. Admitting your product was number 2 had never been done before. To say, Volkswagen is a lemon, or think small and have a little tiny picture of the little beetle, or to call it a bug, was just, well, it set the advertising world on end, because it had, no one dared to be so cavalier with their products before. And then there was the David Ogilvy School, which was do a great deal of research. David said, immerse yourself first in the research, and then immerse yourself in a bottle of wine. And that's how he considered that good advertising was written. But you really had to do your homework, and you had to know the consumer inside and out. You had to know what he or she was thinking and wanted. And then you geared your message to those wants and needs.
And so that's how you came up with the I Love New York campaign. I mean, it is still going strong.
Yes, isn't it wonderful? Every time I go anywhere to any city in the world, I am bound to see T-shirts and coffee mugs that say, I heart somewhere, I heart Paris, I heart London, I heart Tokyo. And I just think, well, it's a campaign that certainly has lasted for a long time and has spread around the globe. And after working for so many years on detergents and toilet bowl cleaners, it's wonderful to know that I was helpful. I played a role in helping the state of New York get back on its economic feet, and particularly help the city of New York.
I feel like you're being way too modest about this and how much you did
truly,
for this.
Truly, there were, you know, they say success has many fathers, and there are a lot of men who took part in the I Love New York advertising, put it together. Charlie Moss, who wrote the line in the first place, the great Milton Glaser, the designer who designed the I Heart NY logo, the man who wrote the music, they can all look you in the eye and tell you they are the father of I Love New York, but I can look you in the eye and tell you I'm its only mother. And to that extent, I was a very good mother. I did hold the campaign together. I changed its diapers, and I gave it its bottle, and I rocked it in my arms. I did an enormous amount of work as liaison between the agency and the state government in Albany, And I think I was in Albany for 5 years more than I was home.
As you were progressing at Ogilvy, did you realize what a pioneer you were? I mean, you started as a copywriter and then you were promoted to vice president. And you were a pioneer, I believe, in both terms of advertising and women's rights.
Well, certainly in terms of women's rights, I was aware of the fact that I was making a statement. When my first daughter was born, I took a week off, and then I went back to work. And when my second baby was born, Mabel met me at the hospital. I handed the baby to her. She went home with the baby, and I went to the office. And I didn't have to. You know, nobody had a stopwatch on me to see if I'd be back in a day or 10 or... But I was making a point that women could, you know, drop babies in the pea patch and head right back to work. And so I knew I was pioneering in terms of women's rights and women's freedom. I don't think I knew that I was pioneering so much in terms of advertising because so much was going on, Katie. The revolution was continuing, and we had all of those people, Mary Wells Lawrence and Jerry Della Femina and George Lois, the crazy Greek, and everybody was breaking rules and doing terrific advertising right and left. So maybe I thought of myself as one of many pioneers.
Are you nostalgic at all for that time in that era that you were working in advertising?
Well, I'm nostalgic for the fun we had, the passion we had for doing advertising, and the camaraderie. We all liked each other so much. We respected each other. We were passionate also about our agency. Those of us who worked at Ogilvy considered it was the best agency that had ever been invented. We adored David Ogilvy, who, by the way, was a gorgeous, sexy, yummy man. All the women had crushes on him, but he never, ever even gave us a second glance. And I'm nostalgic for that. It was a wonderful era that probably won't come back again because the agency world has changed so much. There's much more pressure on agencies today. Clients are asking agencies to do more and make less. So agencies have to ask fewer people to do more. I think the work is harder. The rewards are not as wonderful. And I don't mean just financial rewards. I mean the rewards of saying, oh, I've just done some wonderful advertising. I don't think people have time to work on advertising as hard because you've got much more to do. I watched the Super Bowl, of course, and watched not the football, but the commercials. And I thought that in general, the commercials were not as fresh, not as innovative as they have been in the past years. It seemed to me that our creative folks are trying a bit too hard to be funny, to entertain, and I think the brands and the message are suffering a bit because of that. That may be a little harsh, but that's what I thought watching that parade of commercials.
The name of the book is Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 60s and Beyond. Jean, I can't tell you what a pleasure it has been speaking with you.
And I can't tell you, Katie, how many questions you asked me that nobody else has asked me that really made me go, oop, I haven't thought about that. Thank you for very thoughtful questions.
Again, the name of Jean Ma's book is Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 60s and Beyond. It is published by St. Martin's Press. For the Roundtable, I'm Katie Britton.